You're listening to Leaning Toward Wisdom, the podcast. It's episode 5007, The Death of Empathy. Welcome inside the Yellow Studio. My name is Randy Cantrell, your host here, coming to you from Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, in the wee hours. Morning of April the 25th, 2018. Today we're going to discuss the death of empathy. But first, we're going to let the monkeys, spinning monkeys, go about it a bit longer. Probably is appropriate music because, like an idiot, right before I hit the record button, I decided to sync and back up my iPhone, and presto changeo. There is a new Apple iOS that is downloading. It is iOS 11.3. So if that's you, then I don't know. Maybe I'll be able to tell you how long this is going to take. But like most of these things, it's going to take a while, I suspect, and hopefully it will not disrupt the recording. If you're not inside the Facebook group, go there. You can just go to the website, leaningtowardwisdom.com. And click on the Facebook icon that says Facebook, stay current, join our group, and it will let you inside. And once you're inside, then you will be able to access some video content. It's talking head video, mostly. It's me recording today's show. It is available only to those people inside the group. Just another compelling reason for you to join us inside Facebook. Let's talk about the death of empathy, shall we? On April the 21st, just some days ago, former First Lady Barbara Bush was laid to rest in her home in Houston, Texas. She was 92 years old, the wife of our 41st president. You know, now that I think about it, she was laid to rest. Wasn't she laid to rest in the at the presidential library, her husband's presidential library? I think that's in College Station, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's where Texas A&M exists. She was the wife of the 41st president, the mother of our 43rd president. Pretty remarkable. Two former presidents, Barbara's son, George W., and Mr. Obama. You know, when I grew up, you referred to presidents, even past presidents, as President Obama. I don't know when news organizations began to change that to Mr. Okay, President Obama and President Bush, George W., they shook hands, and there's this photograph with Mrs. Obama, whose name just escapes me. This is what happens when you're sleep deprived, as I often am. George W. has got his head down. Mr. Obama, President Obama, is shaking his hand with one hand, with his right hand, and with his left hand, he is touching the top of President Bush's hand, and George W. just has his head down. It's clearly a difficult time for him. And here is a photograph that would seem to dispel the very title of today's show, The Death of Empathy. But not really. Not really. It was a nice moment. It was a touching moment. Empathy as widespread and as a viral-like experience, I may not be dead, but boy, she's on life support. She's on very serious life support. There's a website. You might find it intriguing if you're into psychology as I am, Greater Good Magazine. Greater Good Magazine. I'll put a link in the show notes. Go to leaningtowardwisdom.com. Just find episode 5007. It is the reason, the only reason, that I have episode numbers so that people can find the show notes easily if they choose to. This website, it's an online magazine. Well, it could be a physical magazine. I don't know. I clearly read it online. It's produced by the University of California at Berkeley. And it's a lengthy quote, but it's good stuff, and so I'm going to quote it. And I'm a pretty good reader, so I hope it won't bore you. But here's how they define empathy at the website Greater Good Magazine, produced by I think in conjunction with the psychology department at the University of California, Berkeley. The term empathy is used to describe a wide range of experiences. Emotion researchers generally define empathy as the ability to sense other people's emotions, coupled with the ability to imagine what someone else might be thinking or feeling. Contemporary researchers often differentiate between two types of empathy. Affective empathy refers to the sensations and feelings we get in response to others' emotions. This can include mirroring what that person is feeling, or just feeling stressed when we detect another's fear or anxiety. Cognitive empathy, sometimes called perspective taking, refers to our ability to identify and understand other people's emotions. Studies suggest that people with autism spectrum disorders have a hard time empathizing. They continue to write, empathy seems to have deep roots in our brains and bodies and in our evolutionary history. Elementary forms of empathy have been observed in our prime relatives, in dogs, and even in rats. Empathy has been associated with two different pathways in the brain, and scientists have speculated that some aspects of empathy can be traced to mirror neurons, cells in the brain that fire when we observe someone else perform an action in much the same way that they would fire if we performed that action ourselves. Research has also uncovered evidence of a genetic basis to empathy, though studies suggest that people can enhance or restrict their natural empathetic abilities. Having empathy doesn't necessarily mean we'll want to help someone in need, though it's often a vital first step toward compassionate action. Does that help? Well, I think it does. I think it does. Psychology Today, and I'll put a link to this as well in the show notes, they tell us six things about empathy that I think can contribute to this conversation. Now, there's much that's been written, and I could have approached this from any number of angles, as you well know, but this is how I'm choosing to come at it today. And here's what Psychology Today tells us, these six things about empathy that I think can contribute to our thinking and our approach to this. First of all, empathy and sympathy, they are not the same. They are not synonymous. And according to them, we feel sympathy for others when we identify with their situation. But that feeling, sympathy, it doesn't necessarily connect us to that person or to what they're feeling or what they're thinking. In fact, it's proven by the fact that we can be sympathetic to somebody's situation, but we don't have any idea what they're thinking. We don't have any idea what they're feeling, and maybe we don't even think about it. Sympathy, the researchers point out, rarely urges us to take action. Now, they do point out an exception. You've seen these really sad commercials for dogs that have been abused or been neglected, and they're trying to get you to write them a check. Okay, well, sympathy can get you to write the check, but it's not going to coerce you to take any real meaningful action, although writing checks is a meaningful action, but you know what I mean. According to Psychology Today, it doesn't build connection. Sympathy doesn't build connection. Empathy does. And here's what they say. This is a pretty good quote. Sympathy is feeling for someone. Empathy involves feeling with them. Pretty good stuff. These cats are bright. Secondly, empathy is not intuition. Research has shown that it's both unconscious and it is also supported by what is actually chemically or physiologically happening in our brain. Neuroscience reveals that when we see other people in pain, it activates some part in our brain that registers pain. And so it would appear that empathy is feeling, it is brain chemistry, and it is physiological as well. And so much of it stems from our ability, or maybe our lack of ability, to employ systematic thinking in order to read other people. Thirdly, empathy engages specific neural circuitry in our brain. That is, the ability that we have, and you can see this, especially with small children, our ability to mimic and mirror other people. We all have that capacity. And that capacity happens in various areas of our brain. And empathy engages those parts of our brain. But empathy is also learned. So this capacity is in us, but yet we learn it. So all of us who have raised kids, we know that little kids have a difficult time regulating their emotions. Infants, they learn from the adults, those of us who surround them in their life. And identifying with these adults in their life, these people who surround them, helps our children learn to regulate their emotions. And being swept up in somebody else's emotions isn't empathy, by the way. And then sixthly, lastly, they point out that the capacity for empathy, it varies by individual. Today, actually, this is number five. I've got one more. I got off in my bullet point list. I apologize. So the capacity for empathy varies by individual. Today, you'll hear a phrase that it's reasonably new, I think, in our vernacular. I didn't grow up hearing it, but I've heard it a lot in the last 5 years or so. Emotional intelligence. Sometimes you'll hear people refer to it as EQ. It is our ability to know what we're feeling, our ability to be able to distinguish what we're feeling from other things that we might could feel, but in this moment we don't. And we can use this information, this data, this research, this, well, it's not research, but this information, we can use it then to better inform our thinking. Helps give us some insight. Our EQ can make it harder or easier to be empathetic. Clearly, the more connected we are with our emotions, the greater it seems we would have a capacity to feel with other people. But it's also our connectivity with other people. It's not just how connected we are with ourselves and our own emotions. People who are isolated, people who are loners, may be less likely, it would seem, to display empathy than those who are well connected socially. And then sixthly, empathy might be more than just about the individual. There are really two parties involved here. There's the person who's extending empathy, to use a verb, and there are those people who are the target of the empathy. And it would seem that they both have a place. In fact, the researchers have pointed out that empathy can depend largely on what others are willing or able to tell about themselves. Translation, kind of depends on how vulnerable you're willing to be about your own self. So it would seem that the person for whom we're feeling empathy, they are as important as we are, as the people who could be displaying this empathy. The article stated that there was a Dutch study of school children. They found that kids with more empathetic tendencies, it occurred when they were reminded by the teacher to be a good classmate. But that empathy declined when it came to choosing sides for a game. And so friends who were chosen last and were upset about it, well, they were comforted. And mere classmates who felt this way were labeled crybabies. Social convention and context, they play a role in how empathetic a person is in a given situation, no matter what the individual's capacity is for empathy. You know, come on, it just proves the power of peers, right? And we can succumb to the peer pressure, no matter if we're kids or adults. Well, hopefully that gives you just a little bit of context. Hopefully that gives you a little bit of insight and more food for thought about this super big topic of empathy. I freely confess it is a deep, deep subject. It is filled with all kinds of nuances that I do not claim to have a full comprehension of. The truth is, I'm just knowledgeable enough to be pretty dangerous about how it works. I'm plenty smart. I'm plenty smart. I'm plenty qualified to be an empathy guru in the sense that I know the power of it. And I'm a lifelong practitioner of it. Now, just here, let me inject a thought or two about some things that I think are very congruent with empathy. And I'll use two words. Well, let's put them in alphabetical order, shall we? Observation and presence. Observation and presence. Here's what I mean. By observation, I mean paying attention. I mean noticing things. I mean noticing people. I mean looking and spotting things. I used to think that this was a universal kind of a thing. I used to think, well, duh. I mean, everybody sees that. I've learned that is not true. It's not true. And yes, I'm empathetic. I'm empathetic to people who do not easily see and naturally notice the things that just seem to leap out at me. Now, the problem is I have no idea at all. Okay, it's not completely true, but it's mostly true. I really don't have much of an idea how to help anybody to improve that necessarily. I'm thankful. I'm very grateful that it's not hard for me. And I know people that it's really hard for, and I'm really at a loss as to how to help them. I grew up hearing about elite athletes. I remember being a kid and, you know, you're watching a game on television or something, and commentators typically are going to be talking about these athletes. And of course, depending on what event and what sport you're watching, these people have various physical skills. Now, the elite professional, come on, they're way ahead of all the rest of us. But the one skill that I seem to envy the most as a kid growing up was speed, the ability to run fast. Now, I was quick. I had really good lateral movement, and I was pretty quick for, I don't know, say 10 yards. But those kids that could run that 100-yard dash, I was fascinated by those guys. I mean, man alive. Me, I'm built for comfort. These kids who could run fast, they fascinated me. I watched them with amazement and wondered, man, what must that feel like? You know, to be able to run that fast. I mean, what must that feel like? I didn't have any idea. I knew they could do it, and I knew I couldn't do it, and I knew I didn't have any idea how they did it. I just knew that my feet, my legs, I can't do that. What you're doing, I can't do that. At some point, I did hear TV commentators or somebody, and I'm sure they were talking about professional athletes, and I heard the term, I don't remember how old I was, but I remember hearing the term vision, about an athlete, an elite athlete, having really good vision. You probably mostly hear that nowadays associated with Wayne Gretzky, for that famous quote of skating to where the puck is going to be, not where it is. Okay, well, that's an illustration of vision. Now, they didn't mean that the athlete needed glasses. They just meant that this, or that he didn't need glasses. What they meant was that this is a player who could just see things that other people couldn't see, or they couldn't see it as quickly as this athlete could see it. This athlete had really good vision. Now, I grew up remembering it mostly applied to football running backs or quarterbacks. You know, a running back who could spot a hole as the linemen are blocking and they open up this hole through which, I mean, if he's got to hit it, and he's got to hit it now because the game's fast and it closes in a hurry. And great vision to see the holes and see the gaps and go against the grain and blah, blah, blah. And then you see quarterbacks and they're reading defenses and they're able to make their first read and their second read and their third read. And they can do all this in a span of just a few seconds. And the faster that they can see things and recognize things, and the faster they can react to those things. And it's a huge benefit, this thing called vision. Well, I knew that. I knew it was valuable. And I knew that, maybe not athletically, although kind of, sort of, I had it. I had good vision. I didn't think about it. It wasn't anything I studied about. It wasn't anything I planned. It was just kind of some autopilot thing that I never did think about. Later in life, in business, it became very clear that this was one of my very limited superpowers. Not in that it was limited, but in that my superpowers are limited. I don't have very many of them, so I have to leverage the few I've got for all they're worth. Early in my retailing career, which lasted from the time I was just a kid until about a decade ago, vision was a big, big part of my success because I noticed things, little things. In fact, I'll go so far as to tell you, I noticed every little thing. Every day I go to a local gym. It's a national chain whose name I won't mention, but it does have a 2 and a 4 in the name. It's a large complex, right? I mean, they've got good equipment and whatnot. It's a very large, spacious one that I go to. I could go to any number of them. This is the closest one. This particular chain, they seem to enjoy moving managers around very frequently because I've never known a manager to be in one place for more than months. And when I say months, I'm talking 4, maybe 6. I can't think of a time where I knew, okay, this person is a manager and they're a manager for like a year. I mean, that I guess they manage in terms of dog years. You know, so if a year is equal to 7, then what's 4 months? I don't know. You do the math. This is important because I'm always curious to see what changes, if any, the new manager is going to make because they come and go with such great frequency. And it's really interesting to me. Rarely, if ever, do they do anything different than the last person did, at least so far as I can tell. Now, I'm just a customer, so what do I know? Well, it turns out quite a lot, I'll have you know. I know quite a lot. For example, I'm a clean freak. I'm a clean freak because, well, I'm a clean freak, and it's the life of a retailer. That includes shops, that includes restaurants, and yes, that includes the gym that I visit. Now, this gym has an outside cleaning crew, and they come through. I know this because I see them every now and again, and they come through, and they've got, you know, they got the vacuum backpack thing, and they're, you know, they're vacuuming the floor, and they're, you know, here's what they do. The cleaning crew, here's what they do. They show up and they just pretty much move the dirt around. They smear it. That's what they do. They don't do much cleaning. They do approach, they approach their work with such vigor though. Imagine, I don't know, pick an age, a 15-year-old hound dog in 100-degree Texas summer heat, laying on the porch, hadn't moved in hours. Yeah, that kind of vigor. That's the cleaning crew vigor at the gym where I go. I don't know how often they come. I see them. I don't see them every day because, well, I don't necessarily go this exact same time every day. I'm assuming they come multiple times a week. They may come daily for all I know. And I watch them and I'm just amazed. I'm just amazed. I think as I go to the gym, and this occurs to me every single time without fail. And again, it's because of vision, because I see these things. I notice these things. I notice a towel that's been left on a treadmill. And I come back the next day and it's still there. And I come back the next day and it's still there. Or there's a railing over here. And there's a towel draped over that. And I come back next day and there it is. And the next day, there it is. Or I see some piece of you know, they've got paper towel dispensers and you can spray this stuff on them to wipe the gear down. And you'll see one of those laying over here somewhere by a machine drying up. And I can come back 2 days later and it's still there. And you're like, what are these people, you know, what are they thinking? And I often think about, okay, I'm going to manage this place. I'm not, but hypothetically. And I think, okay, what am I going to do? I know exactly what I'm going to do. I know what my very first hour is going to look like. Now, it depends on the time of day, but I know what my very first task is going to be. I'm going to assemble all the employees together. And now they've got a kids club. And so if you're watching the kids, then you're going to keep watching the kids. But otherwise, all hands on deck, we're going to clean this joint. And you know what? With the kind of people that this place staffs, it's not going to take us. We can get this done in an hour. I mean, we can make a marked difference in this place in an hour. It's just amazing to me how little people pay attention to the details and see these details. For the last 3 or 4 days, the hand dispensers that have the hand sanitizer, empty. Empty. It's a total crapshoot that you can go up to a paper towel dispenser out on the workout floor. There's a paper towel dispenser, and it's a roll, so you have to pull and pull and pull. And then they've got a spray bottle of whatever that solution that you can, and no paper towels. And if there are paper towels, then the spray bottle is empty. Or, this is a really good one, the spray bottle is full, but you can pull the trigger, and it doesn't work. And so I'll undo it, and I'll just pour it on the paper towel, and then I'll put it back, and you'll watch everybody does the same thing I do. They all untwist it, pour it out, and you're like, how hard can this be? How hard can this be? It's not that hard. But I'm a noticer, and I'm a business guy, and I can't help it. Okay, well, maybe I could. I don't want to help it. Let's talk about presence. Presence isn't just being in a particular place, like, you know, he's present and accounted for. You might prefer words like focus. You might prefer words like concentration. Or you might prefer the phrase paying attention, because that really is what it amounts to. Now, again, what we have is my lifelong profession of being an operator, being a retailer. It proves the point. Constantly throughout my career, I would preach and I would train employees to be present with every shopper. I don't know why this is so hard, but it is. Ever gone up to you walk into a store and you walk up to the counter, maybe it's even a fast food joint, it could be anything, and you're ignored. That's never happened to you, right? It's happened to all of us hundreds of times. The person behind the counter, they're not busy. They're not helping anybody else. They're not busy helping anybody else. They're indifferent, or they're oblivious to the fact that there you stand. They are not present. And that lack of presence hacks you off. Well, it should. Hacks me off. Again, it's inexcusable. Okay, let me pick on my gym some more. I can walk up and you go to the counter and they've got this keypad, like a telephone keypad, and you type in your phone number, and then they've got a fingerprint reader. And so you put your whichever finger you gave them when you signed up. In my case, it's the index finger, and you put that on there and you wait for this scan to read your fingerprint, and it identifies you, and you get some notice in the display that says enjoy your workout, or you get see receptionist. On cold weather, it doesn't work very well. So it's one of those kind of things. So now directly on the other side of the counter, almost, well, 99% of the time is an employee. And a lot of the time you get greeted by these people. Hey, good afternoon. How you doing? I'm doing good. How about you? It's interesting to me, the manager and the person who appears to be her right-hand person, they both happen to be women. That's has no bearing on the story. It's just fact. They can be behind the counter. They're normally not the people manning the counter, but on occasion, like yesterday, they were. Every single time that I go up, and there's nobody else around, and they're not on the phone. They're just talking with each other. They don't even look up. Now, I get that I'm not Brad Pitt. But, I mean, they don't even look up. They're just so not present. They're not present. So I look and I wonder, here I am, I'm 3 feet away, and no greeting, no anything. But here's what I think. I think about leadership, and I think about the culture that this organization must have. And I wonder how long it may be before I have to find another location to go visit. And I'm wondering, will that location be any different? Because I've been to, over the course of 15 years, I've been to probably three different kinds of locations. And yeah, people-wise, there's some difference. But again, I've only been a customer for 15 years or so. So there's that, right? Now, hopefully you can see how these two things are congruent with empathy, observation, and presence. If I'm like the manager of my gym, and I'm busy with whatever I'm busy with, and I'm immune to notice a client who's just 3 feet away, then how empathetic am I liable to be? Well, the answer is not very, if at all. And if I can't or won't notice the client who's 3 feet away, then how can I possibly be present with or for them? Well, the answer is you can't. You can't. In my mind, I have fired this manager and other managers before her. I have fired them so many times, I can't count. Now, here's the thing. She may be spectacular at filling out reports that go back to corporate. In fact, I suspect that she's probably very good. This is a big facility. I suspect that she's probably really good at the stuff that corporate cares about. She just sucks at observation. She just sucks at presence. And I'm betting she sucks at empathy as well. Okay, let me pull back the curtain in case you didn't catch all this. And in case you didn't fully appreciate or understand my snarkiness about all this, the truth is I'm empathetic toward this manager of the gym. This woman is not a kid. I mean, this woman is a mature 40-ish lady who I'm sure has competencies that are important to her role as a facility or manager of this facility. But my business acumen and my empathy make me aware that she is following leadership at a corporate level who likely manage and who likely care about some things while they think some other things, i.e. the stuff I've talked about here, the stuff I've griped about here, not so important. Who needs hand sanitizer in the dispensers? It's okay. Okay, the paper towel dispensers are empty. It's okay. All right, there's towels laying around occasionally. It's okay. Don't worry. Some trash over in the floor. Been there for a few days. No worries. It's okay. So even if leadership can't lead their way out of a wet paper bag, I'm empathetic to the folks who have to carry the water for the leadership. Now you go higher up the level, and I will warn you as a business person, my empathy really starts to wane. And as you get to where the real decisions are made, where the buck stops, guess what else stops for me? Yeah, empathy. That guy or gal's without excuse. Sorry, that just goes with the turf. Funny how that works, isn't it? It's illustrative of why empathy may be dying. Lack of understanding. A lack of tolerance for other people. And I'm not talking about tolerating bad behavior. I'm not talking about foolishness. Because what I've just described at a high corporate level is idiocy. It's just blatant idiocy. But I'll bring it all back full circle. You know I will. I'll bury the lead all day long, but we'll get to it. I'm talking about tolerating a gym manager, in this case, who has to please a boss. And her boss may have, I suspect does have, evidence would prove to me does have, skewed priorities. Now, it would be easy for me to just be hacked and leave it at that. But given my business background, I'm likely more frustrated by this than the average gym member. And I'm also a noticer, so I get that I'm noticing things. Now, how can you not notice when there's no paper towels? How can you not notice when the spray bottle is empty? How can you not notice when there's no hand sanitizer? I don't know, but I imagine there are some people that are just like, oh, well. I'm a business guy, so I'm thinking bad business, really bad business, bad customer experience. It's a really competitive market. There's a ton of gymnasiums around here. There's a ton of regional, national, and local challengers. And I know as a business guy, these are the details that matter. These are the details that pile up and they pile up and they can mess you up. So mostly I feel badly for the company because I know how their performance could be so much better. And frankly, there's nothing stopping them except them, their own willingness to commit to it. That's what's stopping them. But it's their company. They can run it the way they see fit. And so that introduces another part of this big conversation, and that is judgment. Now, before you go off and think judgment, that's a bad thing, I want you to consider your commute to work. How do you determine what route you'll take? If you're in Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, and you don't use Waze, then you're nuts, because with traffic and all that, the great thing about Waze is because it's socially based, it takes into account what people are reporting. And so whether it's accidents or any other road closures and all kinds of things, then it's great and wonderful. How do you approach that intersection where the light just turns yellow? What about the approach to a four-way stop? When do you decide to get gas in your car? Do you wait until that light comes on? Or do you get it at some point when the needle is at a certain place? I mean, all of these things are things that you make judgments about. And some of these things you make judgments in the moment. Some things maybe you give them a bit more thought. You assess what is going on around you. You figure out, okay, this is what I'm going to do based on the information I've got. I think that light's fixing to come on. I see my odometer. I know what it was. I've zeroed out the counter, and now I'm up to 270 miles, and I know that I can only go 300 on a tank, so I got about 30 miles. So all that is judgment. It's judgment, and that's necessary judgment. I notice or judge that my gym has some issues that I know could be easily fixed, but they're not important. They're not important to management. What I don't do, and again, this comes naturally for me, I can't explain it. It just does. I do not infer that this is being done to make my life miserable. I don't think this dirty, rotten gym, they're taking my money. They've been taking my money for 15 years, and they just, at every turn, they're doing everything they can to hack me off. There are people who live their life. I mean, we can chuckle all we want, and it is kind of funny, but it's very real for a lot of people. And so I don't harshly judge my gym. I don't judge my gym manager as inept, for instance. In fact, I rather doubt she's inept. I can almost assure you she is not inept. Now, she could easily, in my judgment, she could easily satisfy corporate and be a great noticer who creates this remarkable facility. And she would likely, you know what she would do? I can tell you exactly what would happen. She would so stand out from her peers. She would be remarkable. It would positively impact her career, I can assure you. Because I've seen countless other managers through the years. I've seen dozens and dozens of managers come and go, and there's no difference in any of them. She could make a difference. She could make a huge difference and satisfy corporate. I know that. I can make that judgment, but I don't have to judge her harshly. You know, she's a dirty, rotten so-and-so because she doesn't do that. Okay, that's her choice. Yeah, she would have to do some things differently. And she would have to do some things that clearly her bosses would not necessarily reward, at least in the short term. But my intuition tells me that if she would do those things over the long term, oh yeah, she would leapfrog her peers. I can guarantee it. That's how confident I am. But it's her career, and I'm not gonna live it for her. It does mean that she would have to be fully cooperative with corporate, while at the same time being a bit of a contrarian and clean the joint up, do all these things that evidently corporate doesn't much care about. And I realize that's not easy. It's doable. I get that it's not easy, but hey, come on, being remarkable is not always easy. In fact, being remarkable isn't easy. Being extraordinary is not easy. I'm talking about the kind of judgment, though, that disrupts empathy. The judging that we do when other people don't do what we want them to do or what we think they should do. If I were her career coach, and I'm not, but if I were, I would be giving her some of this advice. But I'm not, so I don't. And I'm cool with that. It's okay. I'm still empathetic for whatever pressures that I'm rather certain she is under as, whatever they would deem these positions in the grand scheme of all of their leadership. I don't believe in shoulding people. You should do this and you should do that. Here's the culprit. Let's just roll all this up in one big ball of something and label this something. And you want to know what it is? Selfishness. It is selfishness. It is self-centeredness. It's the enemy. And the reason that empathy is dead or dying or on life support is our collective selfishness. Think back of everything that I've talked about, and it boils down to me being the priority, and I don't much care about you. And it creates this lack of empathy. How can it not? I'm too wrapped up in my own stuff. I go up to the counter, manager, there's no acknowledgement that I've even entered the building. Why? They're not thinking about me. They're not paying attention to me. Now, I'm not saying I'm worthy of paying attention to, except for the fact that I'm a customer. It's not because it's me. It's because it's them. And it's to their benefit to have these components in place so that empathy can rule the day. Because, man, at a granular level, empathy is really, really practical. It just is. And selfishness is really, really impractical. We are entirely too focused on ourselves and what we want or what we think we need or what we think we deserve, and we don't get it and we don't get our way and we pitch wall-eyed fits and we get our nose bent out of shape and then we start imposing on other people because it's your fault. You're why I'm miserable. You're why I'm unhappy. You're why my life is not going the way it ought to go, so stop it, because it is, after all about me. And as long as you fit into giving me what I want, giving me what I need, giving me what I think I deserve, then I'm good and you're good. But the second that you start to roll in some way that is not in keeping with what I think is best for me as I see it, then I'm hacked. I'm hacked and it's off with your head. You're a bad person. You're mean to me. You've mistreated me. So I'm a victim. I'm a victim of your poor behavior. I'm a victim of your poor choices. I'm a victim of your unwillingness to do what I ask you to do and be who I need you to be. How dare you? You think you got a life? Yeah, in context with making me happy. What's wrong with you? So long, empathy. It was really good considering you briefly. Be on your way now. We have no time for you because it's not about you. It's about me. And there you have it. You knew this would be easily explained. You really did. And you knew that I would get there eventually. Because it's how I roll, right? Cue the monkeys. I don't know, kids. I just get fascinated by some of these things and go hopping down these bunny trails. I'm still reading the book. Those of you inside the Facebook group, I gave you a teaser and told you I was working on it. This book by Joe Dispenza. And the name of the book escapes me once again. I'm in the throes of reading it. It's really interesting. In fact, it's really, really interesting. And it's going to deserve... It may deserve more than one show all its own. The basic theme of the book is changing our mind, quite literally. And I joked when I first came across the title and thought, well, I need to change my mind. You know, losing your mind so that you can get another one or something like that, so you can get a new one or something like that was a subtitle. And it just struck me as funny. And I thought, well, I've lost the mind I've got. I need a new one. But it turns out Mr. Dispenza, he's a very, very smart guy. I'm enjoying the book. So hopefully at some point in the future, Lord willing, we'll riff on that a little bit. Maybe an episode or two. Visit the website, won't you? LeaningTowardWisdom.com. Again, I invite you to join the Facebook group. There's 130-ish of us inside there, just doing what we do, hanging around, loitering around Facebook, waiting for them to capture our information and destroy our privacy, which we have freely signed away, all of our own. Hey, greetings and welcome inside the Yellow Studio.